Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs. And every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, Why Taking Steps to Combat Loneliness Can Be Good for Your Overall Health, by Leanne Weintraub. Last year, the United States Surgeon General published a report on the epidemic of loneliness and social isolation. Social isolation and loneliness are often forgotten social determinants of health for people of all ages. Meaningful social connection is an essential human need for mental and physical well-being. Recent research has revealed a significant link between social isolation and loneliness and worse physical health outcomes. Unfortunately, these issues are more widespread than other public health concerns, and they are on the rise. About 1 in 4 adults age 65 and older are socially isolated. Social isolation is a lack of relationships and little or no social support. Those who are socially isolated may or may not feel lonely. Loneliness is feeling disconnected or alone, including feeling a lack of close or meaningful relationships or belonging. An individual with many friends and family may still feel lonely. Loneliness affects some people more than others. Low-income folks, young adults, older adults, individuals living alone, people with chronic diseases and disabilities, immigrants and members of the LGBTQ community are vulnerable. Factors that can increase social isolation and loneliness include having a lower income, mental health concerns, chronic disease, long-term disability, being a victim of domestic violence, and life transitions like divorce or job loss, among others. Additionally, people in an ongoing caregiver role can become socially isolated and experience loneliness. A lack of social connection poses a risk to health and longevity. In fact, one study published in the journal American Psychologist found that social isolation can increase the risk of premature death as much as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. Social isolation and loneliness have been linked to an increased risk for heart disease, stroke, dementia, and type 2 diabetes. A new UCLA health study found differences in brain activity related to food cravings in women who feel lonely. According to the study, those who had higher levels of social isolation had higher fat mass, poorer diet quality, more food cravings, uncontrolled eating behaviors, and reward-based eating, as well as higher levels of anxiety and depression. This study provides evidence that reinforces what researchers know about the vicious cycle between poor food choices and negative mental health symptoms. Those struggling with poor eating habits related to mental health may need to take multiple steps to overcome these issues, such as seeking professional help, making nutritious foods readily available, and reducing feelings of loneliness while increasing social connectedness. If you are experiencing loneliness or social isolation, here are some steps you can take. Speak with your doctor or consider consulting with a mental health counselor. Take a class, restart an old hobby, or participate in volunteer work. Stay in touch with family, friends, or neighbors, either in person or by phone, email, text, or video call. Practice self-compassion and positive self-talk. Consider adopting a pet. Join a school or community mentoring program. Participate in faith-based organizations. Check out programs at senior centers, community groups, and libraries. Stay physically fit by joining in on group workouts or walking groups. Next is a related article. It's titled, Sugar Cravings Could Be Caused by Loneliness, According to a Study, by Ebony Williams. If you've spent a lonely night at home eating chocolates or ice cream, you shouldn't feel guilty. That's because loneliness can cause an intense desire for sugary foods, according to a new study. Published in JAMA Network Open, researchers linked brain chemistry from those who socially isolate to poor mental health, weight gain, cognitive decline, and chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes and obesity. Quote, "While it is established that obesity is linked to depression and anxiety, and that binge eating is understood to be a coping mechanism against loneliness, I wanted to observe the brain pathways associated with these feelings and behaviors," said senior study author Arpana Gupta, Ph.D., an associate professor and director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience at the University of California in Los Angeles. The researchers explored how brain chemistry is altered and how it processes food cues based on social settings in 93 premenopausal participants. Their findings revealed those who experienced loneliness or isolation had a higher percentage of body fat and displayed more poor eating behaviors, such as food addiction and uncontrolled eating. Scientists use MRI scans to monitor how the participants responded to abstract images of sweet and savory foods. The results showed those who experienced isolation had the most activity in certain regions of the brain that play a key role in responding to sugar cravings. Those same participants showed a lower reaction in regions that deal with self-control. Social isolation can cause food cravings similar to the cravings for social connections, said Gupta. "We show evidence for the fact that our social bonds are key in regard to how we eat unhealthy foods, especially highly calorie-dense foods and sweets. If you have social anxiety and tend to self-isolate, there are ways to overcome it. Identify your triggers. Journaling what you don't like about an event, including the atmosphere, people, and activities, can help you create a plan to tackle each issue. For example, if you don't like busy rooms, explore why with a therapist or a trusted friend. Instead of jumping full force into an all-night rave, start small with a dinner party." According to Better Up, identifying your triggers will force you to face your vulnerabilities, which can reduce stress. Focus on others. According to Calm, most social anxiety comes from the fear of being judged. When you're out and about, try not to focus on yourself, and instead focus on the people around you. If you're feeling down about yourself, give someone a compliment and strike up a conversation. Or, if you have to, take a break and find an area to do breathing exercises. Replace negative thoughts. For every self-criticism, give yourself at least 3 or more compliments until those negative thoughts disappear. Here are a few examples from the Mayo Clinic. Instead of this, "It's too complicated." Try this. "I'll tackle it from a different angle." Instead of this, "I don't have the resources." Try this. "Necessity is the mother of invention." Instead of this, "I'm too lazy to get this done." Try this. "I couldn't fit it into my schedule, but I can re-examine some priorities." If you're experiencing social anxiety or self-isolation, it's important to seek help and a trusted community to help you overcome the fear. Unchecked overthinking and pessimistic self-talk can lead to anxiety disorders or depression. Our next article is titled, "A Connecticut Woman Used Yoga to Heal. Her Studio Has Created a Sanctuary for Others, Say Clients," by Pamela McLaughlin for the Hartford Current. Stephanie Wheelahan changes lives through yoga, as she did her own life after the grip of postpartum depression led to alcohol abuse. Quote, "I have a deeper capacity to deal with life and stress," said Wheelahan, sober for more than 2 years. I have the capacity to get through life feeling grounded through life's happenings. Since the yoga created such a large shift in my life, said Wheelahan, she became a trained instructor to help others and recently opened Nourished Roots Yoga at 34 Main Street in Thomaston. Whether it's relief from trauma, anxiety, or everyday stress that clients are seeking, or just overall wellness or physical changes, Wheelahan and her team of 7 instructors have just the right remedy, say clients. Wheelahan, by all counts a gifted teacher, has created a warm, inviting space reflective of her personality. Nourished Roots Yoga cultivates an environment where growth and connection thrive. It's not just about attending classes. It's about embracing a deeper practice than what you may find elsewhere, said one client, Sarah Simnow. Each class and instructor serve a unique purpose. Stephanie has created a sanctuary for mindful movement. She is the guiding force behind this space and has crafted a one-of-a-kind environment that feels like home. Student Nicole Ianello said Wheelahan taught the first formal yoga class she ever took, and the impact was powerful. Quote, "It was serene and beautiful, and at the end, she went up to each student to chat and ask how they felt," she said. Stephanie's care and ability to connect with people creates a comforting environment. Stephanie has created a studio that mirrors herself. It's warm, inviting, and it's a comfortable space for all people to practice. Yoga is an ancient and complex mind and body spiritual practice that can build strength, structure, and stability, said Wheelahan. It's become a popular way of promoting overall wellness physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Mentally and emotionally, it helps bring you into a center. You're focusing on what you're doing in the moment. It can result in better health choices and better sleep. Wheelahan, a mom of 2 boys, 8 and 5, said she overcame alcohol abuse through yoga. Wheelahan said while suffering postpartum depression after giving birth to her first son, the downward spiral began. She knew she needed an outlet, but workouts at the gym didn't satisfy me. I was really struggling mentally with alcohol abuse, she said. I was just a mess. I was not well. She turned to yoga, and in her case, didn't use programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous or others. Wheelahan said she has been sober for more than 2 years. A year into sobriety, she studied more about yoga for recovery, and it led her to a program called Y12, which stands for Yoga for the 12 Steps of Recovery. Wheelahan became a trained instructor in that approach and plans to offer it at Nourished Roots in the fall. She said the Y12 yoga helps people cope with anything that made a profound impact on their physical, mental, and emotional health from childhood and forward. The language used during recovery classes differs from other yoga styles and is heavily rooted in finding comfort and support in one's own body, she said. The class offers different options to, quote, come back to yourself and is focused on moving in a way that feels comfortable and geared toward relaxing tension in the body, she said. The language we use is different because it's more of an invitation, said Wheelahan. If it's comfortable for you, you can explore. When teaching from a trauma-informed lens, it's more about experience, I hope, for healing, she said. Nourished Roots Yoga offers a variety of classes from beginners to experienced, she said, and most of the instructors are trauma-informed. She chose the studio name because yoga is about nourishing your roots from the inside out, so one grows into the person they're meant to be. I love to watch people become the best versions of themselves, she said. Most people are healing from something. Wheelahan said she loves everything about teaching yoga. I love the people. I love the students. I love being part of the community, she said. I love hearing how they overcame things. Student Amber Blackthorne said the studio is revitalizing our little town while also building community. It's a welcome space for all to join, whatever the goal or reason, said Blackthorne. She creates a sensation of balance, peaceful, but with room for laughter. The next article is titled, City-Country Mortality Gap Widens Amid Persistent Holes in Rural Healthcare Access, by Jasmine Orozco Rodriguez. In Matthew Roach's 2 years as Vital Statistics Manager for the Arizona Department of Health Services and 10 years previously in its epidemiology program, has witnessed a trend in mortality rates that has rural health experts worried. As Roach tracked the health of Arizona residents, the gap between mortality rates of people living in rural areas and those of their urban peers was widening. The health disparities between rural and urban Americans have long been documented, but a recent report from the Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service found the chasm has grown in recent decades. In their examination, USDA researchers found rural Americans from the ages of 25 to 54 die from natural causes like chronic diseases and cancer at wildly higher rates than the same age group living in urban areas. The analysis did not include external causes of death, such as suicide or accidental overdose. The research analyzed Centers for Disease Control and Prevention death data from 2 3-year periods, 1999 through 2001 and 2017 through 2019. In 1999, the natural cause mortality rate for people ages 25 to 54 in rural areas was only 6% higher than for city dwellers in the same age bracket. By 2019, the gap widened to 43%. The researchers found the expanding gap was driven by rapid growth in the number of women living in rural places who succumb young to treatable or preventable illnesses. In the most rural places, counties without an urban core population of 10,000 or more, women in this age group saw an 18% increase in natural cause mortality rates during the study period, while their male peers experienced a 3% increase. Within the prime working age group, cancer and heart disease were the leading natural causes of death for both men and women in both rural and urban areas. Among women, the incidence of lung disease in remote parts of the nation grew the most when compared with rates in urban areas, followed by hepatitis. Pregnancy-related deaths also played a role, accounting for the highest rate of natural cause mortality growth for women ages 25 to 54 in rural areas. The negative trends for rural non-Hispanic, American Indian, and Alaska Native people were especially pronounced. The analysis shows Native Americans 25 to 54 years old had a 46% natural cause mortality rate increase over those two decades. Native women had an even greater mortality rate jump, 55%, between the two study time periods, while the rates for non-Hispanic white women went up 23%. The rural-urban gap grew in all regions across the nation, but was widest in the South. The increased mortality rates are an indicator of worsening population health, the study authors noted, which can harm local economies and employment. As access to and quality of health services in rural areas continue to erode, rural health experts said the USDA findings should spur stronger policies focused on rural health. Alan Morgan, CEO of the National Rural Health Association, said he found the report shocking, though unfortunately not surprising. The disparity warrants greater attention from state and national leaders, said Morgan. The study does not address causes for the increase in mortality rates, but the authors note that differences in healthcare resources could compromise the accessibility, quality, and affordability of care in rural areas. Hospitals in small and remote communities have long struggled, and continued closures or conversions limit healthcare services in many places. The authors note that persistently higher rates of poverty, disability, and chronic disease in rural areas, compounded by fewer physicians per capita and the closure of hospitals, affect community health. Roach said his past job as an epidemiologist included working with social vulnerability indexes, which factor in income, race, education, and access to resources like housing to get a sense of a community's resilience against adverse health outcomes. A map of Arizona shows that rural counties and reservations have some of the highest vulnerability rankings. Janice Probst, a retired professor at the University of South Carolina, whose work focused on rural health, said many current rural health efforts are focused on sustaining hospitals, which she noted are essential sources of health care. But she said that may not be the best way to address the inequities. We may have to take a community approach, said Probst, who reviewed the report before its release. Not how do we keep the hospital in the community, but how do we keep the community alive at all? The disparities among demographics stood out to Probst, along with something else. She said the states with the highest rates of natural cause mortality in rural areas included South Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, and others that have not expanded Medicaid, the joint federal and state health insurance program for low-income people, though there are efforts to expand it in some states, particularly Mississippi. It's an observation the USDA researchers make as well. Quote, regionally, differences in state implementation of Medicaid expansion under the 2010 Affordable Care Act could have increased implications for uninsured rural residents in states without expansions by potentially influencing the frequency of medical care for those at risk, they wrote. Wesley James, founding executive director of the Center for Community Research and Evaluation at the University of Memphis, said state lawmakers could address part of the problem by advocating for Medicaid expansion in their states, which would increase access to health care in rural areas. A large group of people want it, but politicians aren't listening to their needs, he said. James also reviewed the report before it was published. According to KFF polling, two-thirds of people living in non-expansion states want their state to expand the health insurance program. Morgan added the study focused on deaths that occurred prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, which had a devastating effect in rural areas. Quote, COVID really changed the nature of public health in rural America, he said. I hope this prompts Congress to direct the CDC to look at rural-urban life experiences during COVID and since COVID to get a handle on what we're actually seeing nationwide. In Arizona, the leading cause of death for people 45 to 64 in 2021 in both rural and urban areas was COVID, according to Roach. The next article is titled, Ozempic Oops Babies Spark Debate About Weight Loss Shot Use as a Fertility Drug, by Madison Muller. A surprising thing is happening to some women on weight loss drugs who've struggled with fertility issues. They're getting pregnant. That's leading to questions about the safety of medications from Novo Nordisk, AS, and Eli Lilly and Company during pregnancy. Quote, I thought I couldn't have any more kids, said Toria Leggett, 40, who had been trying for another after her first child was born in 2018. In 2022, the social worker from Whiteville, North Carolina, began taking Novo's Ozempic to treat obesity and then switched to Lilly's Mounjaro. As the pounds melted off, there was soon another reason to celebrate. She was expecting. Quote, "The weight loss, that's likely what jump-started it," she said. "I couldn't believe it." Stories like these are encouraging doctors to use GLP-1 drugs to treat polycystic ovary syndrome, one of the leading causes of fertility in U.S. women. Yet they're doing so without much data on the drug's impact on pregnancy. The oops babies on Ozempic and Wegovy are happening all over the place, said Melanie Cree, director of the PCOS clinic at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora. "It's very exciting, but it's a bit scary because we're moving forward without all the data." The need for treatments is severe. Despite its prevalence, no drugs are approved for PCOS, and experts are divided on whether commonly recommended diet programs work. Some doctors and patients are willing to try almost anything, and the successes are tantalizing. GLP-1 drugs have been marketed for nearly 20 years to treat diabetes, and their use in obesity is fueling a new market that's expected to hit $100 billion in 2030. The problem is, companies haven't systematically studied GLP-1's use in PCOS and don't plan to anytime soon. In the absence of data, researchers are doing studies of their own to figure out if the drugs work for PCOS, and U.S. regulators have asked the companies to collect any information they can about their use during pregnancy. So far, the safety data look promising. A recent study of the health records of 50,000 women with type 2 diabetes found no increase in birth defects among those who used the drugs in very early pregnancy, compared with those who took insulin. Still, the study's author said additional confirmation is needed, especially in women without diabetes. Researchers from Copenhagen concurred last year in a review of GLP-1 drugs, saying that there's a limited information on their long-term safety, particularly concerning pregnancy outcomes. Reasons for concern came mostly from animal experiments. The active ingredient in Novo's drugs has been linked to increased birth defects in animals. Similar studies of Lilly's drugs have shown there may be risk to the fetus from exposure during pregnancy, the company said. No one is exactly sure how or even whether the drugs contribute to women becoming pregnant. Weight loss is known to boost fertility in women with PCOS, and studies have shown that Saxenda, an older obesity drug, also raised pregnancy rates in women with the disorder who were overweight. GLP-1s may also have the hormonal effects that promote fertility and may blunt the impact of oral contraceptives. Some experts think the drugs might even have a role in male infertility. Rekha Kumar, a reproductive endocrinologist at Weill Cornell Medicine, says GLP-1 drugs, quote, "wake up the ovaries," resetting the reproductive environment for normal function. After treating patients with infertility and obesity for more than 15 years, "one thing is clear," said Kumar, "these patients are becoming very fertile." PCOS is a somewhat mysterious condition that typically involves irregular ovulation and high levels of male hormones called androgens. It's the most common hormonal disorder in women, putting them at increased risk of diabetes, heart disease, and mental health issues. Drug at least 2 months before trying to get pregnant, while Zepbounds recommends that people who become pregnant stop the drug. People like Leggett, who got pregnant on a weight loss drug, also have some questions. She sometimes wonders why her daughter is smaller than other kids the same age. "She's teeny tiny," said Leggett. "I'd like to know more about that." That's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have questions, call the Chris Radio listener line at 860-727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long until next time.
Hello and welcome to some interesting and helpful information on diabetes. Study suggests exercise may help counteract genetic risk of type 2 diabetes. And the source is the University of Sydney. New research has revealed being active could lower the risk of type 2 diabetes, even in people with a high genetic risk of developing the medical condition. The University of Sydney-led study found higher levels of total physical activity, especially moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity, had a strong association with a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. The findings were published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. The researchers say the study demonstrates higher level of physical activity should be promoted as a major strategy for type 2 diabetes prevention. The study involved 59,325 adults from the UK Biobank who wore accelerometers, activity trackers worn on their wrist, at the start of the study and were then followed up for up to 7 years to track health outcomes. The UK Biobank is a large-scale biomedical database and research resource containing anonymized genetic, lifestyle, and health information from 500,000 UK participants. This included genetic markers associated with a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. People with a high genetic risk score had 2.4 times the risk of developing type 2 diabetes when compared with those with a low genetic risk score. The study showed more than an hour of moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity per day was associated with a 74% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes when compared with participants who did less than 5 minutes of physical activity. This was even when other factors, including genetic risk, were accounted for. Another compelling finding was that participants with a high genetic risk, but who were in the most physically active category, actually had a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes when compared with those with a low genetic risk, but in the least active category. Senior author associate professor Melody Ding from the Charles Perkins Center and the Faculty of Medicine and Health says although the role of genetics and physical activity in the onset of type 2 diabetes is well established, until now most data was self-reported and there was little evidence whether the genetic risk could be counteracted by physical activity. We were unable to control our genetic risk and family history, but this finding provides promising and positive news that through an active lifestyle, one can fight off much of the excessive risk for type 2 diabetes. Associate Professor Ding says moderate intensity physical activity describes movements that get you sweating and slightly out of breath, such as brisk walking and general gardening. Examples of vigorous intensity physical activity include running, aerobic dancing, cycling uphill or at a fast pace, and heavy gardening such as digging, all activities that make you out of breath or cause you to breathe heavily. Study to help inform public health guidelines. Diabetes is a global public health concern. In 2021, there were 537 million adults living with diabetes worldwide. Almost 1.2 million Australians were recorded as living with type 2 diabetes in 2020. Our hope is that this study will inform public health and clinical guidelines so that it can help chronic disease prevention for health professionals, organizations, and the public. And the next article is from the Duke University Medical Center. Tirzepatide has unique activity to stimulate insulin secretion, suggests study. Tirzepatide, a drug approved for diabetes and on the fast track for approval as a weight loss therapy, works through a unique ability to activate two different mechanisms the body uses to control insulin secretion and energy balance, Duke Health researchers report. The finding reported in the journal Nature Metabolism suggest this is the first study to use cells from human donors to demonstrate how tirzepatide stimulates insulin secretion, an important action utilized by this drug to lower blood glucose in patients with type 2 diabetes. Understanding the potential of drugs that target more than one mechanism opens a whole new world of discovery for better weight loss in diabetes drugs, said senior author Jonathan Campbell, PhD, associate professor in the departments of medicine and pharmacology and cancer biology at Duke University School of Medicine and a member of the Duke Molecular Physiology Institute. Tirzepatide is marketed under the brand name Mounjaro. It and similar therapies are known as receptor agonists, meaning they bind to a certain receptor in cells, triggering a specific action for that cell to carry out. There is a long history of diabetes therapies that target the glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1 receptor. For people with type 2 diabetes, these GLP-1-based drugs restore insulin production and lower blood glucose. The therapies also make people who take the medication feel full longer and reduce appetite, which leads to people dropping weight over time. This has made GLP-1-based therapies very attractive for the treatment of diabetes and obesity. Tirzepatide is unique in this class of drugs, in that it targets not only the GLP-1 receptor, but also an additional receptor for the glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, GIP. In theory, this additional receptor gives the drug a broader range of activity inside the body. However, the GIP receptor has historically been overlooked as a target for metabolic disease, with some people even proposing to block this receptor rather than activate it. This history fed speculation for some time in the field that the activity of tirzepatide at the GIP receptor was not important, inferring that tirzepatide worked as a super GLP-1 receptor agonist. Campbell and colleagues originally expected to find that most of the activity of tirzepatide was at the GLP-1 receptor, but in experiments using donated cadaver islet cells, they found that it was the GIP receptor that was indispensable for the insulin secretion that occurred when the islets were stimulated with tirzepatide. They also found that tirzepatide stimulated the production of glucagon, another islet hormone. GIP stimulates glucagon secretion while GLP-1 inhibits it. The finding that tirzepatide stimulates glucagon secretion is more evidence that this drug has important activity at the GIP receptor. Because our work shows that tirzepatide is a true multi-receptor agonist and not just a super GLP-1 receptor agonist, it validates the potential of using single molecules with activity at more than one receptor as a viable approach to treat metabolic disease, Campbell said. Extending these studies to the cell types that control appetite and body weight should be an important and exciting future direction. And from Medical News Today, metabolic syndrome increases the risk of all types of cancer, study finds. New research shows that worsening metabolic syndrome, which is present in more than a third of adults in the United States, carries with it an increased risk of developing cancer. Metabolic syndrome is not a single condition, but rather the term applied when a person has three or more of the following markers: central or abdominal obesity, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high serum triglycerides, and low serum high-density lipoprotein. It's been established that metabolic syndrome and its underlying conditions are associated with cardiovascular issues as well as type 2 diabetes, but this new study shows how metabolic syndrome contributes to cancer risk over time. The findings, which analyzed nearly 45,000 adults in China with an average age of 49 years, were published in the research journal Cancer. Two doctors interviewed by Medical News Today said that the research highlights the importance of early intervention as a way to limit one's risk of health conditions later in life. The individual conditions that comprise metabolic syndrome all carry their own health risks, but the overlapping of these multiple risk factors compound matters further. The risk of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes increases with metabolic syndrome, and the research out of China shows that cancer is another potential risk. Our study can guide future research into the biological mechanisms linking metabolic syndrome to cancer, potentially resulting in targeted treatments or preventive strategies. Formal evaluation of these interventions will be needed to determine if they are able to modulate cancer risk, Dr. Han Ping Shi, a senior study author and surgeon at the Capital Medical University in Beijing, said in a release. Shi and his colleagues reported that over a median follow-up period of more than 9 years, research participants with elevated and increasing metabolic syndrome faced a higher risk of developing any kind of cancer. Of note, the risk of developing kidney cancer was more than 4 times higher than those with low stable trajectory. Dr. Anton Bilchik, a surgical oncologist and chief of medicine and director of the gastrointestinal and hepatobiliary program at Providence's St. John's Cancer Institute in California, told Medical News Today that these findings give unique insights into the long-term progression of metabolic syndrome. This study is unique in that this is a large prospective cohort study, unlike most studies which retrospectively demonstrate a higher risk of people developing cancer with metabolic syndrome. It also evaluates the trajectory of metabolic syndrome over a 4-year period, Bilchik, who wasn't involved in the research, explained. While it is known that inflammation contributes to the development of cancer, this study demonstrates that the combination of inflammation and metabolic syndrome carries an even higher risk of developing several common cancers: breast, colon, endometrial, and liver cancer, he added. A 2017 study from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, found that rates of metabolic syndrome in the United States have been trending upwards for decades. Between 1988 and 1994, slightly more than 25% of adults in the United States had metabolic syndrome. The next period, which encompassed the years 1999 to 2006, saw a slight dip, with researchers reporting that the numbers had fallen to exactly 25%. However, in the third time period, study 2007 to 2012, the numbers rose to 34% of U.S. adults. Dr. Cheng Han Chen, an interventional cardiologist and medical director of the Structural Heart Program at Memorial Care Saddleback Medical Center in California, told Medical News Today that the research is an important reminder of getting screened for metabolic syndrome and taking proactive steps to curb its effects. These results highlight the importance of early and widespread screening for metabolic syndrome in the general public, Chen, who wasn't involved in the research, said. If we can affect early intervention and control the control of the components of metabolic syndrome, we can potentially reduce the risk of developing many types of cancers. The components that make up metabolic syndrome, hypertension, high cholesterol, high sugar, and high body fat, are fairly straightforward to monitor and address. There are many things we can actively do to reduce our risk of cancer in the future. Maintain a healthy weight, eat a healthy diet, get regular exercise, avoid smoking and alcohol, protect yourself from the sun, and follow recommended cancer screenings, Chen advised. And now, from the University of Iowa Healthcare, remote control of blood sugar. Electromagnetic fields treat diabetes in animal models. Study suggests EMFs alter redox signaling to improve insulin sensitivity. Researchers from the University of Iowa may have discovered a safe new way to manage blood sugar non-invasively, exposing diabetic mice to a combination of static electric and magnetic fields for a few hours per day normalizes two major hallmarks of type 2 diabetes, according to new findings published October 6th in Cell Metabolism. "We've built a remote control to manage diabetes," said Calvin Carter, Ph.D., one of the study's lead authors and a postdoc in the lab of senior author Val Sheffield, M.D., Ph.D., professor of pediatrics and of ophthalmology and visual sciences at the UI Carver College of Medicine. "Exposure to electromagnetic fields, EMFs, for relatively short periods reduces blood sugar and normalizes the body's response to insulin. The effects are long-lasting, opening the possibility of an EMF therapy that can be applied during sleep to manage diabetes all day. The unexpected and surprising discovery may have major implications in diabetes care, particularly for patients who find current treatment regimens cumbersome. The new study indicates that EMFs alter the balance of oxidants and antioxidants in the liver, improving the body's response to insulin. This effect is mediated by small reactive molecules that seem to function as magnetic antennae. Serendipity and collaboration. The initial finding was pure serendipity. Sunny Huang, Carter's co-lead author and MD PhD student interested in metabolism and diabetes, needed to practice taking blood from mice and measuring blood sugar levels. Carter offered to let her borrow some of the mice he was using to study the effects of EMF on brain and behavior in the animals. "It was really odd because normally these animals have high blood sugar and type 2 diabetes, but all of the animals exposed to EMFs showed normal blood sugar levels," Huang said. "I told Calvin, there's something weird going on here." The findings that these mice had normal blood sugar levels after EMF exposure was doubly strange because the mice had a genetic modification which made them diabetic. "That's what sparked this project," Carter confirms. "Early on, we recognized that if the findings held up, they could have a major impact on diabetes care." The findings held up. Carter and Hong, working with Sheffield and UI diabetes expert Dale Abel, MD, PhD, chair of the UI Department of Internal Medicine, found that the combined wireless application of static magnetic and electric fields modulates blood sugar in three different mouse models of type 2 diabetes. The team also showed that exposure to such fields, approximately 100 times that of the Earth's, during sleep, reversed insulin resistance within 3 days of treatment. EMFs and redox biology. EMFs are everywhere. Telecommunications, navigation, and mobile devices all use them to function. EMFs are also used in medicine, in MRIs and EEGs, for example. However, very little is known about how they affect biology. On their hunt for clues to understand the mechanisms underlying the biological effects of EMFs on blood sugar and insulin sensitivity, Carter and Hung reviewed literature from the 1970s investigating bird migration. They found that many animals sense the Earth's electromagnetic field and use it to orient themselves as well as for navigation. This literature pointed to a quantum biological phenomenon whereby EMFs may interact with specific molecules. There are molecules in our bodies that are thought to act like tiny magnetic antennae, enabling a biological response to EMFs, Carter says. Some of these molecules are oxidants, which are studied in redox biology, an area of research that deals with the behavior of electrons and reactive molecules that govern cellular metabolism. The team collaborated with Douglas Spitz, Ph.D., and Gary Butner, Ph.D., UI professors of radiation oncology, and Jason Hansen, Ph.D. from Brigham Young University, all internationally recognized experts in redox biology, to help probe the action of an oxidant molecule called superoxide, which is known to play a role in type 2 diabetes. Their experiments suggest that EMFs alter the signaling of superoxide molecules, specifically in the liver, which leads to the prolonged activation of an antioxidant response to rebalance the body's redox set point and the response to insulin. When we remove superoxide molecules from the liver, we completely block the effect of the EMFs on blood sugar and on the insulin response. The evidence suggests that superoxide plays an important role in this process, Carter adds. Aiming for human studies. In addition to the mouse studies, the researchers also treated human liver cells with EMFs for 6 hours and showed that a surrogate marker for insulin sensitivity improved significantly, suggesting that the EMFs may also produce the same anti-diabetic effects in humans. Carter and Huang are energized by the possibility of translating the findings to human patients with type 2 diabetes. In terms of safety, the World Health Organization considers low-energy EMFs safe for human health. The UI study also found no evidence of any adverse side effects in mice. The team is now working on a larger animal model to see if the EMFs produce similar effects in an animal that has a more similar size and physiology to humans. They also plan to conduct studies to understand the redox mechanism underlying the effects of EMFs. Their ultimate goal is to move into clinical trials with patients to translate the technology into a new class of therapies. With that goal in mind, Carter, Hong, and Carter's twin brother, Walter, have created a startup company called Gemini Health, with help from the UI office for the Vice President of Research. Our dream is to create a new class of non-invasive medicines that remotely take control of cells to fight disease, Carter says. The multidisciplinary research team also included scientists from the UI departments of radiology, neuroscience and pharmacology, molecular physiology and biophysics, and physics and astronomy, as well as colleagues from Vanderbilt University. And from the medical news today, type 2 diabetes risk may be higher in people with shorter sleep duration. People who regularly sleep 5 hours or less per night are at a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes, regardless of their diet, according to a study published today in the journal JAMA Network Open. Researchers used data from 247,867 participants between the ages of 38 and 71, with a mean age of almost 56 from the UK Biobank to examine the connection between sleep patterns, eating habits, and type 2 diabetes. Participants completed an electronic questionnaire asking, about how many hours of sleep do you get every 24 hours, including naps? They also answered questions about their diet. The scientists grouped the participants into one of four categories of daily sleep duration. 7 to 8 hours, normal. 6 hours, mildly short. 5 hours, moderately short. 3 to 4 hours, extremely short. About 75% of participants reported normal sleep duration. Nearly 20% reported mildly short duration. Almost 4% reported moderately short, and less than 1% reported extremely short sleep duration. Scores for diet ranged from 0, unhealthy, to 5, healthy. Participants' scores were 1% scored 0, that's the unhealthy, 7% scored 1, 17% scored 2, 27% scored 3, 29% scored 4, and 17% scored 5. The researchers noted that prolonged periods of insufficient sleep can contribute to various health problems, including an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. Indeed, they found that people sleeping 5 hours or less per day had a higher risk of type 2 diabetes compared to those with normal sleep duration. The average follow-up period for the study was 12 years. During this time, 3%, 7,905, of participants developed type 2 diabetes. The scientists indicated that increasing daily sleep duration to 7 hours might reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. However, they acknowledged that for some people, challenges could make it difficult to achieve this goal. Some obstacles include work schedules, childcare responsibilities, health conditions such as sleep apnea, and economic pressures. This is not surprising to me, said Dr. Pooya Shafipur, a family and obesity medicine physician at Providence St. John's Health Center in California, who was not involved in the study. When you don't sleep well or for long enough, your insulin levels can be off. You might be hungrier than normal the next day, so your food consumption is also off. Over the long term, these can contribute to developing diabetes, Shafipur told Medical News Today. Although I wasn't surprised, it was reassuring because it provides proof of what I have been saying, he added. I can share this information with my patients that they shouldn't ignore their sleep. Too often, individuals do not make a sleep priority. People use their phones and play games when they should be sleeping. Sleep hygiene is so important to overall health. Although participants with healthy diets did have a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes, the researchers said the study results did not support the idea that a healthy diet could offset short sleep duration. The researchers did point out a healthy lifestyle might lower the risk of diabetes. They identified a small 2021 study suggesting that high-intensity exercise reduced the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Additionally, they noted that a population-based cohort study, also using participants from the UK Biobank, found that individuals with short sleep durations who engaged in regular physical activity could lower their risks of developing diabetes. Exercise directly influences skeletal muscles, which are essential for regulating blood glucose levels. It boosts the expression of glucose transporters in these muscles, enhancing the uptake of glucose from the bloodstream. Christian Benedict, Ph.D., one of the authors of the study and an associate professor in the Department of Pharmaceutical Biosciences at Uppsala University in Sweden, told Medical News Today. While maintaining a healthy diet, such as consuming more complex carbohydrates, also positively impacts blood sugar levels, its effects may not be as significant as those of exercise in counteracting impaired blood glucose control resulting from sleep loss. But not everyone agrees with that assessment. I don't agree that vigorous exercise can lower the risk of diabetes. Maybe in the short term, but I don't believe it can take the place of regular sleep, Shafipur said. Diet and exercise are important, but so is sleep. The researchers did not look at different types of diets, so it isn't clear whether eating plans such as the Mediterranean diet would lower the risk of diabetes in people with short sleep duration. In addition, macronutrients and micronutrients were not explored in this study, so it's not certain if they can counter the effects of short sleep durations. Another limitation is that sleep duration and dietary habits were self-reported. And that's it for today's reading of the Diabetes News. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and please forgive me for mangling the names, medical conditions, and drug names. Thank you for listening.